Well, we've taken a several-week break from our study of the book of Genesis together on Sunday mornings. And this morning we find ourselves back in the book of Genesis, finding ourselves in chapter 27 as we read right through the book. And this morning we come to an interesting chapter, to say the least. The title of my message is A Blessing in Disguise. When we think of that saying, we often feel that it is equated with circumstances that don't seem very comfortable, positive, or healthy, and yet something good happens in the midst of it all. Today we're going to have a understanding of that phrase in a whole new way by the time we finish our study this morning. Each and every time I approach the Bible, I always ask myself, whatever text it may be, what is the overall theme? What is the overall point that God is making within these verses? What does he want us to know and understand? And as I was considering that, as I was praying about that, it became very clear to me that God wanted to remind all of us this morning of something that is incredibly important to know and to understand. In fact, it was Job who said this: I know that you can do all things, and no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Let us understand that no matter what man does, God's purposes and plans are going to be fulfilled perfectly. There's nothing man can do to thwart the purposes and the plans of God. Even if they try to their darndest, they will never be able to exceed God's mandates. And we have to understand that. From our perspective, we see the world in a very limited manner through our eyes, through the microcosm of the day in which we occupy. And often we look at the circumstances surrounding us and determine that God is either doing this or that, and yet we find ourselves often to be completely wrong altogether. We see people trying to resist God, and we find that that's impossible. We see people try to expel God from the minds and the hearts of the people, and we find that to be an impossibility. God's plans will not be thwarted. I think it is interesting that Job came to that conclusion. Job is actually the oldest book of the Old Testament. And in his limited understanding of God, he already came to that conclusion. It doesn't matter what man does. God's plans will go forward. He's sovereign. Nothing's going to stop him. He's God. That could be very terrifying if we didn't know what those plans were. And it could be even more terrifying to discover how those plans would be unfolded. The Bible tells us both. The God in whom we serve and the manner in which he is unfolding his plan because of the love that he has for us. The writer to the Proverbs said it this way: many are the plans in the minds of men, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand. And this is what I see being the main theme of this particular chapter of Genesis. As we are reading through Genesis, we are tracking through the patriarchs of the nation of Israel, the founding fathers, if you will, known as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And currently we've been looking at Isaac, and now we're going to be moving into Jacob, the younger of two sons born to Isaac, the elder being Esau, who should have received the birthright and should have received the blessing. We're going to discover, as God stated it would be, it will be the younger that will succeed his father Isaac. And through him come the promise of Jesus Christ. As we're tracking through the book of Genesis, the book of beginnings, we are seeing the foundation of all that we know to be true in the New Testament. And to truly appreciate all that God has given us in the New Testament, we must have an understanding of the Old Testament. And as we come to chapter 27, we are going to get a snapshot in the life of Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau. And I asked the question this morning, how many of you have a photo album at home of your family? Now, in that photo album, do you have pictures that you're very happy with and proud of, and other pictures you hope that no one ever sees? The fun pictures that you only bring out with your own immediate family? You know, mom waking up with curlers. It's so funny. Then you have the great pictures of dad always looking perfect, you know. Kids being funny. Well, I will tell you that God selected a photo of the life of this family that I'm sure they wouldn't want anyone to have seen. And as we continue through the book of Genesis, as we see the overall understanding that God's plans will be perfectly fulfilled and that his will cannot be thwarted, and though the man has many ideas in his own mind of how things should go, nothing is going to be superior to that of the resolve and the purpose of God. There is also a very practical understanding from this chapter that we need to embrace also and equally if we are going to truly learn all that we can learn from this passage. As a believer, I would say that practicality is this. We are going to reap that which we are sowing. Let me state it in a non-Christian way for you. The decisions we make today are going to affect us in the future. The choices we make today are going to affect us in the future. How many of you have made choices in your life and now have discovered that those choices have had repercussion, consequences, and have truly contextualized your future in one way or another? We all have, right? We all have. Maybe you've made a decision in the haste of a moment to satisfy instant gratification. The Corvette looked great on the showroom floor. It was only one signature away. The monthly payment of $1,300 didn't seem that much at the beginning. And then you realize it was twice as much as your mortgage. And that 1 month that you got to drive it before it was repossessed, you enjoyed thoroughly. But now your credit's been damaged. No more Corvettes for you. We've all made decisions, and I look at that decision, and there's a levity to it, but there are also more significant, serious decisions that we make. And often those decisions have to do with God. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, he reaps. The decision to reject Jesus Christ has lasting consequences. And I see here, the individual Esau has made some decisions in the past that I really believe that he didn't think had any real consequences to them. And yet, now when reality hits and he sees how valuable those things were that he gave away so cheaply, we find him in tears hoping that it could be different. And yet, the decisions he made could not be reversed. A do-over was not provided. A mulligan was not happening. So as we read through this, the snapshot of the life of Isaac and Rebekah, his wife, Jacob and Esau, let us begin in verse 1. As we read, when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son," and he answered, "Here I am." And he said, "Behold, I am old, and I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, and that my soul may bless you before I die." We are going to learn of this process of blessing. This has a very distinct understanding to it. A blessing at the end of a person's life upon his eldest son or his son to succeed him was like the execution of one's personal will. And from the very beginning, God said that the succession would go to the younger of the twins, Jacob. But something's happened in the life of Isaac. And though God assured him three times in chapter 26 of Genesis that God was with him, past, present, and future in each tenses, asking him not to fear, that God was going to see all things through according to his plans and purpose, for some reason at this point in life, Isaac seems to be getting ahead of God and taking things into his own personal hands rather than waiting on God for God to bring about his plans and purposes perfectly. We know that Isaac is old. We're told that twice. He's 137 years old at this time. Remember, those in the Old Testament lived a lot longer due to the environmental factors, which we studied earlier on in the book of Genesis. And his eyes seemed to be getting dim, meaning it was getting harder and harder for him to see. And here, at this point, it's almost to the point where he is blind. Thinking that he was about to die, and possibly the reason he thought that is because his brother Ishmael died at 137. And so maybe Isaac now thought he himself also was going to die at this time. And he calls his eldest son, the first of the twins to be born, Esau, to come in. And if Esau would bless him with a bountiful meal, one of his favorite things to eat, wild game, Isaac would then now bless Esau with that blessing, as we had mentioned, which would enact or execute the final will and testimony of Isaac. Now here's the crazy thing. Isaac is actually going to live 43 more years. So oftentimes, like Isaac, we find ourselves thinking that we are in a certain position, right? When in actuality, we're not in that position at all. It's because of our limited perspective, that microcosm of the day. We think everything's ending, and God says, oh no, there's still time, you'll have to go, and so forth. And he's getting ahead of the fact. He also seems to be superseding the will of God. You know, God said that Jacob would inherit this blessing, the validation of the birthright. Let me back up. Esau was born with a birthright. That means since he was the first, he had the right of the firstborn. And he was to succeed his father in all of the family affairs. But one day we read earlier on in Genesis that Esau was hungry and he sold his birthright to his younger brother Jacob for a bowl of stew. And he basically despised his birthright. It didn't mean anything to him. He was perishing at the moment. He felt he was dying because he was starving. He went out and hunted all day and didn't catch anything. And for a meager bowl of stew, he sold the precious birthright in which he had been born with to Jacob. That seems to have now escaped his thinking. And as Isaac now tries to bless him to validate the birthright that he has been born with, there is one thing that we must note as we read this, that it is meant to be a celebratory time where the whole family would enjoy this moment, but they're doing it privately. We know that the Bible clearly stated that Rebekah, Isaac's wife, loved Jacob of the two twins, the younger one. We know Isaac loved his elder boy, Esau. And there was favoritism that now is playing out in the family. I know all about favoritism with my parents. I was their favorite. I still am. In fact, with my mother-in-law, I'm her favorite son-in-law. It just, you know, I don't know what it's like not to be the favorite. I'm kidding. You could ask my sister. Yeah. Well, that's right. My mother-in-law is here today. Well, so that being said, favoritism can cause great havoc in a family, can't it? If you've ever really seen true favoritism and thinking that your parents favor a sibling over you, it can be very difficult. And we see great division caused by this favoritism amongst the parents towards these two. And in all appearances, it appears that Isaac now is trying to step over the mandates of God, the desires of his wife, and showing favoritism to his son Esau tries to bestow the blessing, the validation of the birthright to him. But verse 5 then comes about. Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. The word listening in the Hebrew could also be translated eavesdropping. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, her favorite, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, bring me game and prepare it for me, prepare for me delicious food that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice as I command you. Go to the flock and bring me 2 good young goats so that I may prepare for them, from them delicious food for your father, such as he loves. And you shall bring it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies. But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, behold, my brother Esau, he's a hairy man. That's what Esau means, hairy. And I'm a smooth man. I'm a smooth operator. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing. His mother said to him, let your curse be on me, my son, and obey my voice, and go and bring them to me. So he went and took them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared delicious food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the young goats she put on his hands and the smooth parts of his neck. And she put the delicious food and the bread which she had prepared into the hands of her son Jacob. What was that famous line from the poet Sir Walter Scott? Oh, the web we weave when we practice the deceive. It's almost as if Rebekah had premeditated this, right? Anticipated this. This is really hard for me to believe that she did it on the fly. It is very possible that was the case, but she knew what to do. Jacob, we're going to send you in. He's a blind old man. He's not going to know either way. We're going to send you in with some food that I'm going to prepare. And we're going to take the skins of the goats that I'm going to prepare, and we're going to put them on your hands. And the word hands there in Hebrew is up to the elbows. And we're going to put them on the sides of your neck. What does that say about Esau? I got to just ask that question. If we are substituting the hair of goats for Esau, and we're going to make it up so you're going to appear to be like Esau. And it's interesting that Jacob doesn't seem to be concerned if this is a right or wrong thing to do. He's more worried about being caught and being cursed. Yeah, Mom, what happens if I get caught doing this? And Dad curses me rather than blessing me. See, Jacob was more concerned about the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. But he's going purposely to deceive his father to inherit that blessing, to receive that blessing. As one wrote, when we are willing to abandon the question of right and wrong, and when our only concern is that what works, we agree with the modern idea of pragmatism, as many in the church do today. It's a means to an end. As long as the end seems justified in the eyes and the heart of God, the means do not matter, really. I challenge you on that thinking today. Is God glorified by this? Did God need their help in bringing about his purposes and plans? As we will notice in just a moment, when Jacob approaches his father, he's going to lie to his father 5 times, and the lies are purposely architected to deceive his father and to receive the blessing. Does God need this kind of help in his endeavors and in his plans? We don't know her motives here. Some scholars want to think that all Rebekah is doing is trying to be obedient to the Lord here, but we don't know that to be the case. We know she received that word from the Lord as she prayed and inquired about the conflict that was going on in her womb as the two twins fought night and day and struggled to a point where she thought she might even lose her children. We don't know what her motives were here, but the means by which she executes whatever motives she has is certainly not honoring to God. Let us be very careful that when we go about serving the Lord, living for the Lord, that we do not try to justify sinful means to fulfill the purposes of righteousness. God is not glorified in these things. As we will now see in verse 18, so Jacob now prepared in this. Now here's another misconception. Many view Jacob and Esau being twins. Well, maybe they're in their late 20s, early 30s. Do you know how old they are at this time? 77. 77-year-old man is now taking orders from his mom to dress up with goat hair. What's wrong with this picture? And Esau at 77 must have been a strapping fellow if goat hairs are needed to replicate his appearance. This is just wrong on so many levels, isn't it? I mean, this is just not the snapshot that you would have the Holy Spirit record in the Bible of your family at any particular time. Do you feel better about your family now? Well, we always used to joke in our family, and I can tell you that next to the word dysfunctional, it was a picture of our family. We were nothing compared to this group here. This is like a sitcom TV show that I'm watching before me. And he goes in verse 18 at 77 years old now with goat's hair strapped to his hands and on the sides of his neck. So he went into his father and said, "My father," and he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" And Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn, and I have done as you have told me. Now sit up and eat of my game, that your soul may be blessed." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" And he answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Really? Don't you love it when God gets dragged into our sin? He's trying to validate what he's doing. He's trying to authenticate it. He's trying to give it justification. Do we think God is pleased by this? Does God need our help in this way? And then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near me that I may feel you." That's an interesting thing for a father to say. "My son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not." This hairy thing must have really been well known within the family. So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him and he said, "Are you really my son Esau?" And he answered, "I am." And then he said, "Bring it near to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him and he ate. And he brought him wine and he drank. And then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him. And Isaac smelled the smell of the garments and blessed him and said, stop there. Of course, Isaac is suspicious. How many times does he ask Jacob, "Are you really Esau?" Because you sound like Jacob, but you feel like Esau. He even goes one step further, "Come and kiss me so I can smell you." You want to talk about dysfunction? It's in every part of this story. And smelling the garments that Rebekah had arrayed Jacob within, once again, Isaac is convinced that this is Esau, his oldest son, when it yet in disguise is none other than his younger son, Jacob. Now, one of the things we must be concerned with always is that if we are to fulfill the plan and purposes of God by these type of means, how can we ever be sure that God is really in it? We don't want to get ahead of God in any way, shape, or form. And I see that in this illustration, this particular account, very dramatically. The Bible says that we walk with the Lord as individual Christians. And I think about an illustration that God showed me years ago when I went to the mall with my daughter. As my daughter and I were entering the mall, we were following another parent who was having a very difficult time with her two children. Two little boys. And as she was making her way from the parking lot into the mall, I could tell that each boy had his own thoughts about where they should go. One boy didn't want to go anywhere. He just kept sitting down in the middle of places saying, "I'm not going any farther." And she'd have to run back and pick him up, grab him, move him on. But yet while she was doing that, the other boy, of course, was nice and assisted her in the process. No. He kept running ahead of her. So as she's walking, one is bolting ahead of her and the other one is far behind. And after we got into the mall, I held the door for her because at that one moment she had unity in her family. But after she stepped over the threshold of that door, they bolted in same directions. And it was a problem throughout the time as we were walking actually behind them. And Autumn said something to me. She goes, "Those boys aren't behaving." And if you remember little Autumn, she used to say those kind of things. We're so cute at that time. Now she's a teenager and I don't know what's happened. And I said to her, I said, "Autumn, you know, this is a great illustration. Notice that those little boys are being disrespectful and disobedient to their parent. One little boy is running ahead, the other little boy won't go where his parent would like him to." And I said, that's so often the same way it is with God, with people. Some like to run ahead of God and often get themselves in many problem situations, thinking that they know best, thinking that they can navigate this world without him, and as long as he's back there somewhere, they feel secure enough to continue to run ahead of him, but also, oftentimes they run off a cliff where he would have avoided that altogether if they would have just stayed with him. There are other Christians who lag behind, who aren't willing to go where God is leading them. They're stubborn. They're resistant. They won't move when he moves. They won't be obedient to what he says. And they too are in a very bad place, never truly understanding what God might want to do in and through them. And then I heard the mother say something that, of course, has become the go-to motivation for most parenting today. "If you two don't behave, I'm not going to buy you a toy." And still yet, they didn't behave. They didn't get the reward that they were meant to get because one ran ahead, the other one lagged back. So as I was walking with my daughter, I thought this was a perfect time. And I looked down with her and I said, "Honey, do you notice we're walking together?" And she goes, "Yeah, Daddy, I'm not going to leave you." And I said, "You know what? You get their toy." So often I see that in the lives of Christians. One running ahead, one lagging behind. But God says, "Walk with me. Walk with me." And it's interesting, as she walked with me, she was always like just a step behind because of my stride was bigger than her little stride. And so she always knew where I was and her hand was in my hand. And she could be confident of that. That's the relationship that God wants to have with you. But Jacob here is trying to take something that God would have given him by means that are certainly not glorifying to God. And here is the blessing that also becomes prophetic. Within it is not only the validation of the birthright that was sold to him by Esau many years earlier, but also will demonstrate what God is yet going to do. Notice with me in verse 27, "So he came near and kissed him. And Isaac smelled of his garments and blessed him and said, 'See, the smell of my son is the smell of the field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and the plenty of the grain and wine. Let peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who is cursed, and blessed be everyone who blesses you.'" In this blessing, we now see that Jacob will now succeed his father as God said he would. This is not a means to an end. This is God's will being played out in the free will of man. The sovereignty of God is not that God creates robots that just obey him because they have no choice to do otherwise. The sovereignty of God is so majestic that God works within the free will of man, and each and every time man thinks that he is making his own decision, God is 10 steps ahead. That's why I'm so confident of God. That's why I can trust God so unequivocally and unapologetically. It's because the minds of man doesn't matter in what God does. It's not that they are just mere robots in his hands. Free-willed agents being governed by a sovereignty that is so spectacular that God's plans are perfectly unveiled. Jacob shall be blessed with the prosperity of this world. That's what's found in verse 26. He will be blessed politically, and we see that through the nation of Israel. Later on, we find that through Jacob, his name will be changed to Israel, governed of God, and he will be then one of the three patriarchs of the nation of Israel, the Israel that we have today. And then adding to it the blessing that Abraham received from the Lord, that everyone who curses you and be blessed, everyone who blesses you. And so God now transfers and succeeds this succession with Jacob. Jacob is not being rewarded for what he has done. It's not that Jacob's scheming has prevailed. God's purpose and will has succeeded. And yet, in the means by which Jacob executed this, brings no glory to God at all. In verse 30, as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. He also prepared delicious food and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me." And his father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" And he answered, "I am your son, your firstborn." And then Isaac trembled very violently. This is an interesting phrase in the Hebrew. We can't miss it. He was so moved by the fact that something had just occurred, and he has now realized the truth of the situation. Some believe that he is so convicted at this point for trying to go against the will of God by blessing Esau rather than Jacob, in whom God had anointed, who had destined. But he is quivering. Some Hebrew scholars believe that this trembling was so fierce that he actually fell off whatever bed or seat he was upon. Very violently he shook and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him. And yes, he shall be blessed. There's no going back. It is done." Look at what he says here. And as soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing." No, that's not true. Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob?" Jacob means trickster, one who supplants. Remember when Esau came out of the womb, Jacob appeared to be fighting with him for that firstborn position and actually was held on to his ankle as Esau was born. Remember that back in earlier in Genesis? "He has cheated me these two times." No, there's revisionist history, Esau. You sold him that birthright because you were famished and you gave away something so precious for something so meager. "And now he has taken away my blessing also." Then he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" And Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Behold, I have made him lord over you, and all his brothers I have given to him for servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, son, my son?" And Esau said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. This is when reality hits. The consequences of his actions. At no time did Esau ever desire his birthright. Until now at the end, when he sees there's some type of material value in the blessing, does he desire it. But he made a decision now that was made, and now he could not go back and redo. This is so important for us to understand today, that decisions that we make today can have lasting consequences. And when they come to concerning God, they can have eternal consequences attached to them. This is so important for you and I to understand. He's weeping bitterly because he can't go back. There isn't a do-over. What has been done, and this is what God has decided, even though it came in a way that by no means glorifies him at all. So Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, "Behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. But by your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. But when he grows restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Through the descendants of Esau came the people of the Edomites, who were antagonistic and enemies towards Israel all through the Old Testament. They were a desert-dwelling people, just as predicted here by Isaac that they would be. They were a military people. They were an aggressive people, just as predicted here. And in 2 Kings, we discover that at one time they are allowed to overthrow Israel, in 2 Kings chapter 8, verses 20 to 22, just as Isaac said they would. So not only these blessings contain the validation of the inheritance, but they also are prophetic in the outplaying of what takes place next. Let's conclude the chapter and just read it through. "And now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, 'The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob.' But the words of Esau, her older son, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, 'Behold, your brother Esau comforts himself about you by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, arise and flee to Laban, my brother in Haran, and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away, until your brother's anger turns away from you and he forgets what you have done to him. And then I will send and bring you from there. And why should I be bereaved of both of you in one day? And then Rebekah said to Isaac, I loathe my life because of the Hittite women. Now, Esau had married Hittite women, which disqualified him also from being the successor, but he didn't consider that. Now, if Jacob marries one of these Hittite women, like of course his brother did, that's what she's saying, like these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me? What kind of offspring can I have with women such as these? Send him away. Of course, her plans being executed. Now, here are more consequences. He's going to be gone for 20 years. She's never going to see her son again. Esau is going to pursue Jacob, his younger brother, and hunt him down for 20 years. All of this because she got ahead of God. All of this because she tried to make something happen and not wait upon the Lord. All of this because Isaac perceived that he was in a certain place and he was about to die when yet he had 43 years more to go. Here is what I say to you today, now knowing what we know. Let us not be rash to jump to conclusions about the particular circumstance that we are faced with at any one particular time and draw conclusions about the nature, character, or plan of God within our lives. Let us be very careful that we are not determining or predetermining what shall take place from this point forward simply on the basis of our limited understanding. He is God, I am not. His ways are vastly higher than my ways. Let us be understanding. To know nothing of man can thwart the sovereignty of God. Let us understand that though men have many ideas in their minds, it is the Lord's purposes that unfold. Let us understand that to bring about an end result, a result that we think is going to honor God or be in obedience to God, God would never have us to sin to do so. Right? Let us understand that from our perspective, and Genesis just annals for us all these different individuals who handle faith in God. Let us understand that we can trust God, and God is faithful to His promises, and He is faithful to His plans, and He will unfold them perfectly in His timing, in His way. We don't have to get in the way of what He is doing. And let us understand that we are not glorifying God through our sin. We are grieving God in our sin. And did not God have the last laugh by recording for us in Genesis 27 this one snapshot of Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau in the Scriptures for all eternity? A chapter of what not to do. Oh, the web we weave when we practice the deceive. A blessing in disguise.